but it's gonna take money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Jeff Madrick, author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. Jeff Madrick is a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst. He currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times, in addition to other publications. He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as Taking America, The End of Affluence, and The Case for Big Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Thanks for inviting me, Ian.
And, of course, we're talking about the U.S. economy, the age of greed. I think in many ways, Jeff, your subtitle sort of says it all, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America. Now we have an economic hostage crisis here in America, completely fraudulent, generated for naked political reasons. And yet the whole country seems to be sort of sleepwalking and not in any way being outraged. I mean, you got the, you know, the head of the Fed and everybody else are saying the sky is falling. But meanwhile, we just sort of, the press reports this economic extortion, this political extortion, as though somehow it's reasonable. I mean,
I think, you know, there are a few things going on here, the most important of which is lack of leadership. We don't have any national voice angry as a heck about this. It's one of the great political follies of our history, this argument about how austere our economic program should be at a time when we are creating no jobs. It's stunning. And the press has no serious independent voice in all this. They go with the flow in Washington. And so the right of the right have been unleashed. The right, the pure right, is hampered even by those to the right of them. And the president caved in, we have to remember, caved in on this issue way back when he appointed that commission, Simpson-Bowles Commission, to offer a budget balancing plan. Appointed two conservatives, one very conservative Republican and one conservative Democrat, to come up with this budget balancing plan over time. So he already threw in the towel, claiming our priority is budget balancing. It's hard for me to blame the people for not getting angry about this. They have not been led. They have not been taught. They have not been given the proper information on it.
Well, the extraordinary thing, apart from the president essentially buying into the Republican canard that the economy is somehow connected to the debt and that they're not separate issues to be dealt with separately, the president himself in his recent press conference said, what we need to do is make this big bargain that I'm offering. And clearly the incremental drip, drip, drip of the Republicans is designed for maximum political leverage. Nobody in their right mind would agree to any of their proposals. However, I think he's got the cart before the horse. He's got the whole thing backwards. He said, after we get our big deal signed before the whole roof crashes in, then we're going to get to jobs. Well, God, I mean, why not start out with jobs? Yeah. And frankly, the job situation will solve the deficit situation if people get back to work.
Well, there's no doubt you're right. And he, one reason the Democrats lost the last election big is Obama and many Democrats have no idea how big the jobs crisis in America is. It just doesn't seem to be in their heart and soul. It stuns me. I've written about this quite often. They don't seem to get it. I agree with you completely. We have to get the economy running properly again and then deal with balancing the budget And balancing the budget in the long run, we hear all this panic about huge, huge deficits down the road. Almost all of that has to do with health care, which is driving up Medicare and Medicaid costs, and then resulting in higher interest on debt. All of it in the late 2020s. And this idea that we've got to deal with it now, you know, this is the theme of Age of Greed. There was an ideological shift, and the book starts in the 1970s, way back then, compounded over time by the growing political power of Wall Street and of moneyed vested interests. But the ideology, I fear, is something that Obama believes in. He believes government must be small. He believes taxes must be held down. He believes in budget balancing at most times. This is all an ideology that developed right out of the Milton Friedman playbook in the 1970s, and we haven't been able to shake yet. I kind of joke, Ian, that, you know, Obama is part of this 40-something generation that never knew a time when government, when people had faith in government, and when government was a place where people were proud to work and get things done, and social policies expanded. He has no experience with that. It's kind of a repeat of the Clinton years, and they led to these years.
And of course, I don't know. Is it your word, greedism?
Paul Krugman and Robin Wells raised it to what might be the term of our time,
right?
In a New York Review of Books piece.
Well,
but greedism is a good way to put it.
And it essentially became sanctified under Ronald Reagan. And I don't know the extent to which the president is somebody that doesn't recognize the Democratic legacy and the importance of the New Deal as it's being slowly undone. However, just in terms of tactics, I just am astounded at his negotiating style, where he comes in asking for much less and ends up with much less.
The New Deal plays a big part in my book, because a lot of the people who led the deregulation wave and the anti-government ideology wave were children of people who hated the New Deal, literally. But there was nothing so distressing to me as Obama reading a biography of Ronald Reagan to seek guidance about how to restore optimism in America. He really should learn something about FDR. FDR was far from perfect, as you know, and the progressives disagreed and thought he wasn't always progressive enough. But when he fought for an awful lot and changed an awful lot. He fought hard, and he called his enemies what they really were. And there was none of this, let's negotiate and play nice, and the golden mean between our points of view is always the answer. He knew he had to get things done. He was quite extraordinary, and he changed the spirit of America and changed the purpose of government in the minds of Americans. And that's the lesson Obama should have learned, instead of some lesson about happy talk that Ronald Reagan was so good at.
Well, Jeff Madrick, somewhere in my files, I've got an audio tape of Ronald Reagan campaigning for Harry Truman,
right,
in 1948.
Right.
And his speeches then, when he was a union leader and everybody in the country was on the left anyway in those days, just about. Compared to today, they were far left.
Right.
His speech back then, his campaign speech for Harry Truman, is identical to the subsequent speeches that he made in his political comeback leading up to his 1980 election. And all you have to do is substitute in 48, he was saying that big corporations are the enemy. All you have to do is take the word big corporations out and substitute it with big government. It's exactly the same speech.
I think in my book, Age of Greed, I have a chapter on Reagan, and I talk about that. You know, he always needed some big evil monster to attack, and in those periods when he was still a New Dealer, as you point out, corporations were the evil monster. And then he switched. And the switch, I do talk about the switch. The switch is kind of an interesting phenomenon, but he too was affected by the New Deal. He was so good at fooling himself that he wrote in his second autobiography, An American Life, which was kind of a canned production, he wrote that he believed FDR would have cut down the New Deal over time and cut Social Security. It was quite an extraordinary. The man had a great talent for fooling himself.
Well, Jeff Madrick, the author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. I just spoke also with, there's a nonpartisan group in Washington called the Center for Responsive Politics. They've done a study on this new revolving door between lobbyists and who've become congressional staffers. And apparently, there's been a huge bump in this since this new Congress, and most of these new lobbyists turned congressional staffers are working for Tea Party candidates, which really gives a lie to that whole idea that the Tea Party's in anything but astroturf right-wing front for plutocrats. I mean, they're the worst whores on the hill, this crowd, by the look of it. But the thing that makes me nuts is that all those people on the hill have got jobs. And you were just saying that the political class does not understand the pain in America and the extent to which people are looking for jobs and how long they've been looking for jobs and the need to get this country working again. They give lip service to it, but they don't understand it. In the midst of this, this guy, Ryan, who's trying to eviscerate Medicare and cast our seniors into the poorhouse, by having to pay for stuff that they don't have to pay for now, he's, according to Politico, he's hanging out at the most fancy restaurants in Washington with lobbyists drinking $350 a bottle wine.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
I mean, this is where I don't understand the American people don't see the disconnect between their lives and the lives of these people that are supposed to be representing them.
Well, you know, not too many people are talking about that disconnect. Part of the problem is the press, and the Washington Press Corps in particular, are part of that world. You know, they party with these people. I'm not saying they're drinking $350 wines, but some of them are probably, and it's pretty distressing. I agree with you. Americans have to understand there is a jobs crisis, but they have to communicate that to people, their representatives in Washington. And I think it's a worse job crisis than even most economists are talking about. Since the recovery in mid-2009, when we're supposed to increase numbers of jobs and wages, profits rose by something like $500 billion, and salaries and wages have risen by something like $5 to $7 billion. That is a stunning fact. There is something very serious going on in America, and there is no evidence the president is paying any attention to this. And I believe it is the ultimate outcome of 40 years of this age of greed, of growing greedism, as we now put it, and you know, went from politicians to business people to the financial community to crisis after crisis that we told we solved, and we really didn't solve the problem. All along, we have misallocated our precious savings going into financial paper shuffling instead of productive investment and reinforcing this ideology in which it's hard to talk about what's really going on in America.
Well, that's the question I've always asked people that cover finance that I interview. Since 2008 and before, is that how long can American capitalism be sustained if at least 40% of it, Wall Street, is based on extracting wealth, not creating wealth? I mean, the original function of Wall Street was supposedly to be the means by which you create wealth, the investment for the robber barons, etc.
You know, they argue that they still create it. It's just simply no longer the case. And so I'm completely with you on that. People, I've been giving a lot of talks. People are very concerned, frankly, just judging by the crowds that come out, you know. And people say, well, what's the happy ending? What do we do? Why, you know, you don't seem to be giving us a way out and so forth. And I can think of solutions. But I tell them, you know, my message is really to alarm you. My message is to have Americans get over the idea that somehow their future is guaranteed. We will muddle through once again and solve our problems the way we always did. We solved our problems in the past by fighting for them. Roosevelt fought rough battles for the things we got in the New Deal. And there are many examples of that before then. But we also made bad decisions, or we developed half solutions, or we waited too long to come up with solutions. We will not necessarily solve the problem of American decline unless people start to understand it is a real possibility that requires action, and maybe even radical action and radical ways of thinking of policy changes.
Well, you would think that the writing's on the wall in terms of the American dream and the Horatio Alger mythology and the whole idea of meritocracy being so manifestly bankrupt at this point, where you have essentially a country increasingly in the grip of corporate plutonomy and of powerful oligarchs like the Koch brothers. It seems so obvious to me. And sometimes I know I sound like a broken record talking about the emerging oligarchy. Now, it did happen before in the Gilded Age, it's not as if, but I would have thought in the hearts and minds of almost every American is this belief that this is supposed to be a middle-class country with equal opportunity. I mean, that's the desire. That's the way we see ourselves.
The end of meritocracy is an important point. We really are increasingly living in a class society. I remember one college president telling me, writing somewhere, tell me what college you go to, and I will tell you what area code, you know, what area code you grew up in, or what am I, zip code you grew up in. Because, you know, the demographics of that zip code will determine whether you go to a good school or not. And going to a good school or not in turn determines what kind of job you get. That has occurred increasingly in this country. But it's gotten worse. The idea that wages are not going up at all is stunning.
That's for people who've got a job, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so just in closing then, Jeff Madrick, Paul Krugman, in reviewing your book in the New York Review of Books, concludes that the United States is on a track to spending the better part of the next decade experiencing high unemployment, subpar growth, blighting millions of lives, particularly the old, the young, and the economically vulnerable.
He's right. We're not dealing with our economic problems. We're not expanding the economy.
Well, that shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody who's paying attention to what's happening on Washington. Not only are we not dealing with it, these people are behaving like idiots, like children, like petulant teenagers.
Yeah, they are. But, you know, somehow or other, I think people still are afraid of budget deficits. And we've got to understand we need a budget deficit now to get the economy back on track. And the press has to help them understand that. And the press is playing the game of Washington. It's not whether we should balance the budget right now. It's how we do it. Well, the fact is, the question is, should we be thinking about balancing the budget now? We should not. We should be thinking about getting the economy back on track and figuring out how to make decent-paying jobs in America. And if we don't do that, we're in very deep trouble. And I think the press is handmaiden to the folly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jeff Madrick.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, Jeff Madrick is the author of the new book, Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. He's a journalist and an economic policy consultant and an analyst. Currently edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, in addition to other publications. He's the author of such critically acclaimed books as Taking America, The End of Affluence, and The Case for Big Government. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
I was looking at the ceiling, and then I saw the sky. I was looking at the ceiling, I was looking at the ceiling, I was looking.